Yeah, you can come right at the front here. Getting in the front in the sides is no problem. It's just in the middle, in the front. We have to keep this open area here. It's not for security reasons. It is just because of the camera, because these things are streamed live. And as President Cecilia mentioned this evening, I'm just come back from a very long trip. Just this afternoon landed from the flight back from San Francisco. So I am jet lagged, I am tired. But it was a very good trip, and one of the reasons I went to San Francisco was to do more work to support the bhikkhunis over in California. They weren't getting much support, so I wanted to make that connection between my supporters and them so that they can raise some funds and also get more established. And again, going there, giving talks in so many places, including in the Google campus and Facebook campus, so I'm now officially a cool monk. And one of the things which I discovered there, surprise, surprise, that even in a place, you know, like, and I hope somebody from Google is listening to this, because probably it's on there somewhere, that it is still has too much discrimination, even supposed to be a cool company like Google. I was quite surprised that the women in Google, there's not so many software engineers who are female, and those that are being paid less than the males. And I'm always a person who doesn't just teach, but does what I teach. So I was trying to talk a little bit to get against discrimination. And the topic of the talk this evening will be discrimination, not just gender discrimination, but the whole way that people get discriminated against in our world. And you may have been a victim somewhere of that discrimination. It's not very nice. Even monks get discriminated against, and I'll mention that later on. But in particular, I did sort of try and advise people not just to talk about it, but do something about it. So I suggested to, you know, quite a big talk to quite a few people, if they really think there is a problem in the Google campus over in Mountain View somewhere about gender discrimination, don't just sit there, do something about it. So I suggested that they should have a day of protest by all the men, as many men as possible, coming to work dressed as women. So if there's not enough women there, at least it looks like there's enough women. And certainly that will get into the 9 o'clock news, you know. So if that actually happens, you know, if you see it over here, there was a day of protest, you know where it came from. Because I'm full of ideas. And one of the reasons is, you know, that being meditating, getting very still, you do get very creative. And it's one of the interesting things about mindfulness, stillness, kindness. Put them all together and you might get so still and energized, you can actually see things in a different way. As I often say, and I said this also in Facebook, that when you live outside the box, you actually see outside the box. And too many people, that's right in the box. Because they're right inside the box, yeah, with the best will in the world, they can't think outside the box. They can't see outside the box. Because they live in the box. As monks and nuns, we're actually totally outside. But one of the things which you see that just prompted me to talk about discrimination. And of course, you start off with the obvious one of gender discrimination in religions, which is totally unacceptable. But to let you know, because someone told me this, and I think it should be spread around as much as we possibly can, that actually it is possible legally to actually ordain women as Catholic priests. And because I was told, because I'm part of the new movement in Theravada Buddhism of establishing a bhikkhuni sangha, I was told by a source, and it's believable, that in Catholicism you follow canon law. That's like the legal system there, which even the Pope has to follow. And apparently in canon law it does actually say that you are forbidden from ordaining a woman as a priest on land. But there is a loophole. You can ordain a woman on the ocean. And apparently a very senior Catholic in South America has actually done this. And there's nothing the Pope can do about it. She's a legitimate female Catholic priest. They're just trying to suppress it. But my talks go out to many, many places. And so I'm sorry, Your Holiness, the cat's out the bag. You can do ordinations as women in the Catholic Church. You prefer Catholicism, get an archbishop, get a boat, and you're fine. But I love being a bit of a rebel. messing up other religions. But anyway, with Buddhism, a typical thing which I hope you learn here is you don't just argue against it. Yeah, it's good to do a day of action in Google if that really works. But the most important thing is to say, why? And what is the cause of these problems? So that's a very typical Buddhist thing. Yeah, here's a problem. Why? Why is this cause? Why is there discrimination? And of course it is because, there must be something to be gained from discrimination, some advantage. That's why people discriminate. That's why you have power. Those who are discriminated against don't have that power. This is one of the reasons why. And one of the solutions is, to take away that power. And why do people think they need power over others to discriminate against them, put them down? You probably experienced that ever since you were children. When people put you down, they put somebody else down. And you don't need, to have big issues such as gender discrimination. You can see just how people who are mentally disabled, physically disabled, who have sicknesses, who are of different races, obviously, or different religions, do get discriminated against, which is really weird. I don't know those of you in Western Australia that lucky are Assistant Secretary, who also told me, just to make you know, I think we're only 10 members short of 4,000. She's trying to get a goal of 4,000 members before our AGM. Only 10 short. That's our goal. 10 more if you're not a full member yet. Please join up to make the 4,000. Is it 4,000 or 5,000? Remember, Cecilia? It's a big number anyway. So anyway, it's 4,000. 4,000 members of our Buddhist society, so we go over the 4,000 one. Anyway, going back to reality, why people would sort of discriminate, I don't know if you saw, she sent me this news clipping, that there was a big high-profile legal case where a young woman was contesting the will. And I think it was one of Lang Hancock's, Peter Wright, I think it was, his daughter. And she was apparently awarded $25 million from the will, but on condition she never converts to being a Buddhist. Or Islam or Buddhism. Islam or Buddhism. And if she even comes in here, that her inheritance is threatened. Now that's really weird. Why do even people think like that in today's world? And there is some idea there that discrimination obviously comes from a lack of understanding, a lack of education, a lack of actually seeing what is really going to be beautiful and helpful for our world. And when I read things like that, I don't worry about her becoming a Buddhist or not, nowhere in the world she probably would be, but just the very reason that a person would say that and be discriminatory. That if they say that she can't inherit if she becomes a lesbian, if she becomes a vegetarian, if she supports Fremantle instead of the West Coast Eagles, there's something which is really crazy in such things. So that is like discrimination. Why does that feel essentially wrong? And it feels essentially wrong because there is no basis for distinguishing between just a West Coast Eagles fan or a Fremantle Dockers fan of this person with this preference or with that religion. Because once we do have those differentiations, then we have the discriminations, then we have so many problems in society there is no peace, there is no happiness, and also we are not using all of our resources by working together rather than with working against one another. So I always say in our modern world, if you know, not forever, you know, we need to cooperate rather than compete. And if we learn how to cooperate more than compete, then of course discrimination will be lessened. Discrimination arises from competition. And so, you know, trying to be innovative, one of the ways of overcoming the competitive nature of our society, which means, you know, that we're always trying to attain something and do better and get something more. I was talking to somebody over in San Francisco about whether ever, because it's Sri Lankans, there's lots of Sri Lankans over there, and there apparently is the World Cup cricket going on tonight. If there's not many Sri Lankans here tonight, it must be the game Sri Lanka is playing tonight or tomorrow or whatever. Because, you know, even Sri Lankan Buddhists, you know, when it's a competition between a cricket match and Buddhism, I'm sorry that you are supposed to be Buddhist, but cricket always wins. It's true, you know. We were sort of talking about sort of many things about sort of you know, discrimination. And one of the things they said is, you know, because of competition, there's even competition in religion as well, inside of a religion. You know, competition, what we call spiritual materialism, to get on, become better, and compete with even your friend of how deep your meditation, how advanced you are. That's why so many people in Sri Lanka are always trying so hard to become stream winners and comparing each other. And somebody told me this really funny story. This is not a joke, although it should be a joke. This is a real story. There was one of the Sri Lankan women who came up from the small village somewhere way in the deep, inaccessible parts of Sri Lanka. And she came down to Colombo. She was a very pious Buddhist. But they thought, no, let's give her the real Buddhism, not just the ceremonial stuff. And so they had this course, meditation and Dhamma course. Now, some very weird parts of Buddhism. And this particular weird part of Buddhism, after a two-week course, somebody offered it to her, paid for her, you know, meditation, Dhamma, and they gave an exam at the end. And at the end of the course, they gave an exam, and the examiners, if they really thought that they were good, they would give them certificates, stream-winning certificates, wondrous returning arahat certificates. They gave them stages of enlightenment certificates. It's a bit weird, but this is what happens when you get into that sort of stuff. Of course, people are competing, you know, to see, you know, are you a stream winner? I got that last year. Now I'm an anagami, non-returner. So anyway, this is an old lady, very pious, and thought, you know, what the difference, we'll give her, but they'll sponsor her. So they sponsored her, and after 2 weeks, they gave her the exam, and they said, yes, very good, you're a soul one, a stream winner. And they gave a certificate, the stream winning certificate. Now, those in Sri Lanka know just, wow, stream winning, that's really high. One of the first stages of enlightenment. There are four stages of enlightenment in Buddhism. And she was so upset. She was so angry. And she started shouting at the examiners. I said, what do you mean? Why are you so angry? You're a stream winner. That should make you very happy. But she scolded them and shouted them. Why don't you like this? And she said, don't you remember, I was here last year and you said I was an anagami. I've been demoted. That's a crazy part of religion. And anyway, why are we comparing with one another? This is one of the wonderful things which I liked about Dhamma, about Buddhism, is what the Buddha called the three conceits. And this is basically the spiritual underpinning to totally dismantle all discrimination, wherever you find it, whatever it is. And that was the three conceits. This is what is wrong view, wrong understanding. This is not the way to look at things in life. And the three conceits is a conceit that I am better than somebody else. That's a conceit. That's a wrong view. That's an ego. Now, number two conceit is very common in our Western world. I am worse than somebody else. I am inferior. That's the second conceit. I don't know how many people have a lack of self-esteem. They think they're not good enough. They're not good enough to, say, learn sort of a new musical instrument. They're not good enough to meditate. They're not good enough to find a good partner. I don't deserve anyone. She is out of my league. Or whatever you think. That inferiority idea is the second conceit, which the Buddha said is wrong view. That's a very dangerous wrong view. That leads to lots of problems, depression, guilt, anxiety, and obviously lack of success and progress in your life. You don't think you're good enough to do anything. Well, not anything, but there's many things many people here think they're not good enough to do. Yes, you are good enough. You know that when I was a school teacher for 1 year, that there was a kid in my class, this is one of my stories, a kid in my class who came bottom in math the year before. It's an experiment I did. And I spent special extra time with this one child because I just wanted to find out, is it you become bottom because you can't do maths? Is it a lack of ability, something wrong with your brain? Or why is it that people come bottom in a subject? You know, 30 kids in a class. This was in the UK in 73. And it just took me one school year. At the end of the school year, when he got the exam results after the year end, this kid came top in math. And I was blew my mind. But it did confirm something I suspected. Now I knew it. You know, you suspect it, but now you know. There isn't such a person in the world who can't do math. I've got to call it maths. I've been in the United States. Now I keep getting on the wrong side of the car. And you know, if you've ever been in there, they say, oh, get in there, Ajahn Brahm, and I get in the driver's seat. And I just wish people would just standardize all of this. So anyway, doing maths. So I thought, is it the case that people can't do maths? They can't do accounting, they can't do science, they can't do English? No way, that is not true. It is their belief of inferiority or inability, when they think, I can't do this. Obviously, then you won't. And with that one kid in the maths class, all I did was to give him confidence. That's all. Confidence that he could. And he did. And I was right. So that second conceit is, I'm inferior. I can't do this. I'm not as good as others. That is a conceit. The Buddha pointed out that is wrong view. For goodness sake, if you're a Buddhist, stop doing that. You're as good as anybody. And the last one is, of course, my favorite of the three conceits, is because we don't ever think this is being conceited. And that is, I am the same as everybody else. That's why for those of you of my generation who saw the religious classic The Life of Brian, where Brian was asked, can you say something profound? And he says, you are all the same. And then somebody put their hand up and said, I'm not. Remember that? That was a brilliant piece of philosophy. And it's, you're not the same. You're not worse. You're not better. You don't discriminate. We're just all totally different. We don't have to be better. We're not worse. We're not the same. We're just different, but of equal value. And when you have equal value towards people, no matter who they happen to be, the ball game changes. And that... okay. This is an old story, but I haven't told this for a long time, I'm sure, here. And this had a lot of traction over in the United States, because when I gave one talk in Sacramento, there was a bishop, I think an Episcopalian bishop, came to my talk, and I gave this this particular story especially for him. He was in the audience. And he got it in the end, and he said, wow, I'm going to use this one in my sermons. And that was the story of the seven monks meditating in the cave on unconditional loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well. You may have heard that in Buddhist talks. You may have even done loving kindness meditation. You may think you're practicing loving kindness meditation. May all beings in the whole world be free of suffering, be happy and well. Okay, so these were monks, supposed experts doing this. And there were seven monks in the cave. Now you have to listen carefully because there's a question comes at the end of this little anecdote. The seven monks were the head monk, you know, the abbot. The next monk was his brother. They ordained together. The third monk was his best friend. They liked each other so much they went to school together, university together. They became a monk as well. The fourth monk was his enemy. Now, even though monks, we have kindness, we try and have all our rules, there are always some people you just do not get on with. You know, have personality clashes. You know, one person wants to do samatha, the other one wants to do vipassana, they're both the same, but who cares? You know, so they had personality clashes. One person liked Ajahn Brahm, the other one liked Ajahn Brahmali. You know, personality clashes. So that was the fourth monk. We called him enemy. The fifth monk was a very old monk. He was so advanced in years that he could die any day. You know people like that, they're just on the edge of death. They can pop off any old time. That's why they say when old people like that go to the funeral of their friends, you always see them at the cemetery. I do lots of funeral services. And you see all these old people at the cemetery because it's their friends who die. And sometimes you do wonder that you know, no point in them going home. They should just stay in the cemetery for... Well, it's only a few days. So anyway, that was the old monk. The next monk, he was a really sickly monk. He, you know, if it wasn't this disease, another disease. You know the people like that, they're always sick. And this one, he was all so sick that he could die any day too. And no one actually knew. If they weren't monks, they'd probably put some sort of betting on who would die first, the old monk or the sick monk. They were that close. It was even odds. And the last monk, number seven, he was what in Buddhism, in monastic Buddhism, we call the useless monk. In other words, when he started to meditate, every time he'd fall asleep. But worse, we don't mind people falling asleep when they're meditating, but he snored as well, really loudly. And when he tried to chant, he'd always chant out of key. And his robe kept falling off. Mine's on today, so I'm not the stupid monk. And he was just, you know, whatever he did, he couldn't do it. He was a useless monk. When I told this story over in San Francisco, Ayatata Loka, she was the person who ordained many of our bhikkhunis. She was there, and she's starting a monastery, and I said, Ayatata Loka, that's the name for a bhikkhuni, every monastery will have a useless monk. If you haven't got one yet, you will get one soon. I'm sure Dhammasara's got one, or two or three. But anyway, that was the useless monk. Okay, so now you've got the seven monks. Now, a band of thieves, robbers, gangsters, they found that cave in the middle of the jungle where these monks were doing this meditation on loving kindness. And they wanted to take it over. But of course, if they let all the monks go, surely one of the monks would tell the police and it would be hopeless, it wouldn't be useful for them. So they wanted this place, you know, to store all their stolen goods and to hide while the heat was on so they could not get caught. And once, you know, people forgot about them because other crimes happened, then they could leave and steal again. So it was going to be this hangout. But they realized they'd have to kill every one of those monks. Otherwise, one of the monks would say the location where the thieves were going to be living. But the head monk, like many senior monks, we're really good at talking. especially getting donations out of you. So that was the reason I was going over to California, to squeeze many donations to support the bhikkhunis over there. They were getting really, really very, very poor. They were in moldy huts. And I was actually, this is really nice news. I managed to get a commitment from one of the people in Google to get $1.3 million to pay for them. So good old Google. Google rocks. I also went to Facebook. They haven't committed anything yet. So please put this on your Facebook page, on my Facebook page. I went there, no commitment yet. But Google, they're really getting somewhere. So I told them, you know, in order to get this on my, the story of the bar in San Francisco. It was run by an ex-quarterback. You know what quarterback is? This is American football. He's the big guy, the most well-paid person in the team, really strong. An ex-quarterback, you know, he'd retired, and he bought, with all his money, he bought a bar. He was really such a tough guy that had this running competition in his bar that if he cut a lemon to make a drink and squeeze the lemon juice in to make a drink, if anybody at all could take that lemon and squeeze three more drops out of it, they would get a free drink. And of course, many guys were there, ex-wrestlers, US Marines, Navy SEALs. I learned that in the United States. They're supposed to be the tough guys. Anyone over there, if they could take that lemon and squeeze even three drops out of that lemon, they get the free drink. I know some guys, you know, professional weightlifters, even the old governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, tried it. He only got one drop. But then came this small guy from Australia in a bald head and brown robe. Well, not that small. His roundness. He took that lemon. After it had been squeezed by the quarterback, he squeezed 4, 5, 6, 7 drops. And they asked, "What on earth are you doing? What are you doing in San Francisco? You're so strong." He said, "I'm raising funds for the bhikkhunis. I can squeeze a lemon which has already been squeezed dry even further." That's what's called a fundraiser. Anyway, that was what I was doing over there to raise some funds for these for the people. But also, it's just no talking about. Oh, that's right, the 7 monks in a cave. I'm jet lagged. Okay. So the head monk was such a good talker. That's where I was come from. Squeezing more drops out of a lemon. Squeeze more donations out of you guys. So such a good talker. Managed to convince the robbers. The head of the robbers, anyway, to let all the monks go except for one. The robbers insisted that one monk would have to be killed in front of all the others as a warning, that they were serious. That if any of those monks, which were released, told the police the location of the cave, these robbers would come to them and do the same. They needed to be warned to show they were serious. And that was the best the head monk could do. So this head monk had this really awful choice in life. You know, he had to choose between all these monks who would die so all the rest could go free. So, the bishop was in front of me when I said this story, and I said, "Okay, who was chosen?" And I went through the list of monks again. You know, the head monk, his best friend, his brother was number two. The brother, they loved each other, would do anything for each other. And the best friend, too. You know, if you were a friend, you'd sacrifice everything for friendship. The fourth monk was the enemy. He didn't really like. He'd make it much more peaceful if he was the one gone. The fifth monk, a very old monk. He lived a full life. He was at the end of his life. Or the sick monk, you know, who's going to die anyway. Or the useless monk, throughout his whole life had done nothing to help other people. So those were the 7 monks. Now, many of you know this story, because it is in opening the door of your heart. You know, or in America it's called Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung. The reason why we gave it two different titles is because people don't realize it's exactly the same inside, and by both, therefore, we make twice as many sales. Well, that's not the reason. They preferred calling it by the dung title. So, who was chosen? And you know that when I'm not going to ask this for you to put your hands up, but you know, have a think, what's your answer? The bishop, you know, he put his hand here, he said he chose himself, obviously. And that's what many people in Australia say, and in America, and in Europe, they say he chose themselves. Wrong answer. And I ask any other suggestions, and so how uncharitable people are, they say the useless monk. I don't know why they do that. Actually, I do know now, it's called discrimination. Somebody in your company is looked upon as being useless, and you sack him or her. That is unfair. Discrimination. Now, this is one reason why I tell that story. So the bishop was quite surprised that was the wrong answer. A bit embarrassed, because he's supposed to be the bishop, he's supposed to know something. And I told him the answer, and he really smiled. He said, yes, I understand now. And the answer was, there was no way that monk could make a decision. Why? He'd just be doing loving kindness to all beings. May all beings be happy and well. Unconditional, indiscriminate. Which meant, in practice, he loved his brother exactly the same, no more, no less, than he loved his best friend. And he loved the enemy exactly the same, no less, no more, than his brother and best friend. He loved the sick monk, the old monk, even the dear old useless monk, exactly the same, no more, no less. And what's really important, he loved himself no more, no less, than all the other six monks. And I reminded the bishop, you know, I was brought up as a Christian before I became a Buddhist. I didn't have any choice when I was born. Apparently my parents, they put me in a bowl of water in the church and they baptized me, but that doesn't count because they never asked. It was without my consent. I was about 3 weeks old at the time or something. I think ever since that time, when I was a kid anyway, I never liked baths. I think that was probably the reason why. Anyway, his love for himself, no more, no less, than love for others. And I told his bishop, look, don't you remember in your Bible, which you're supposed to teach, didn't your teacher, Jesus, say to love your neighbor as yourself? Which means to love yourself as your neighbor. Didn't say to love your neighbor more than yourself. He said, as yourself, no more, no less. So to love yourself as you would love every other being in this world, no more, no less. In other words, this lack of self-esteem, this discrimination, the biggest discrimination is against oneself. Now that is actually quite powerful. If you can actually see that and solve it, most psychologists will be out of a job. So you love yourself as your neighbor, love your neighbor as yourself, love all beings. So not better, not worse, not the same, just different, that's all. And where do you actually accept that? All this discrimination business. Now, discrimination, against genders. Against gay, lesbian, transgender communities. There's so much of that discrimination around even today. But I was stood up for that because somebody actually, they put in a newspaper in the West Australia some time ago, it was an article from the London Telegraph. You know, it was a very prestigious paper. And they were actually quoting His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And it was saying that you cannot be gay and be a Buddhist, period, it said. And that was supposed to be a quote from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And of course, it was misquoted, you know, so please understand that the Dalai Lama never said that, apparently. It was a misquote, but it got in the newspapers, and it was printed here in the West Australia. And imagine just how many people who come here, they came afterwards and say, Ajahn Brahm, is that really true? We're gay, we love coming here, we love being Buddhist. At last we found a religion, a spiritual path which accepts us and which loves us. I said, of course it's true that, you know, you can come here, that that's not what the Buddha ever said. And so actually I wrote, because it was in the newspaper, I had to write a letter to the editor in the West Australian. It was published, of course. And then many sort of the gay, lesbian, transgender community here in Perth said, thank you so much. And it was because of that, that letter, I got my invite to the Gay and Lesbian Transgender Pride Breakfast. I stood, this is what I'm supposed to do. Religious leaders are supposed to lead, stand up for anti-discrimination, what is fair, what is right in this world. This gentleman earlier, he's a really good friend. I keep forgetting people's names because jet lag, I just saw a couple of thousand people in San Francisco. So it's a person whose name I keep forgetting. You know, I tell everyone that. But he was actually saying that when you go to super, because I'm probably forget them 2 weeks' time when I next give a talk here, because I'm going to Hong Kong on Monday for 10 days. Even when you go to the supermarket, please look out for what you buy so it doesn't harm animals, harm people, no sort of goods which are in factory farms or in sweatshops, even buy less, which is always one of the best to do. So please be mindful what you buy, what you purchase, because it's just a couple of dollars for you, but that could be really causing a lot of hurt somewhere down the line. So anyway, I just mentioned that just in case I forget for next time. Maybe I'll say more about that afterwards in another talk another time. But we should never discriminate against anything or anybody in this world. But because I gave a talk at the Gay Lesbian Pride Breakfast, sometimes there is discrimination and you have to do some affirmative action for it. And this affirmative action, which I thought this was absolutely brilliant, I'm sharing it with you now. There was one of the leaders of the gay, lesbian, transgender group over in Tasmania. It was the last of the states in Australia which made homosexuality consensual between adults a crime. And the gay, lesbian community, transgender community over in Tasmania were lobbying the governments for years trying to take this off the books. And the government were always saying that, we won't prosecute, it's just one of those things. But even though it's there, it's discriminatory. You know, just because, you know, they're not going to act on the law is there. In other way, they got that law overturned. This is a great example of when there is discrimination, how to overturn it. What they did was about 50 gay couples, and they knew it was against the law. They'd done all the lobbying. Nothing was working. So they decided to have one night of extended, intense sex. They chose a night, 50 couples all together, and they logged it. They recorded everything they did in a statutory declaration. They signed it afterwards. Yes, we did this. And these 50 couples handed themselves in into the police station the following morning. Say, we committed a crime. You have to arrest us. Of course, they alerted the media, so the TV crews, newspapers were in tow. And the police had no choice. You know, they'd broken a law, it was on the books, and they confessed, they'd actually written down their confession, and the police had no choice but to arrest a lot of them. And I remember I met one of the police officers who had to put these people in jail. A week later, she resigned out of disgust of her job having to do this. And of course, actually, about 10 days later, you know, the state government of Tasmania changed the law. They had to, because they were just so embarrassed. There was discrimination put right in front of their faces, which is one of the problems. Sometimes when we have discrimination, it goes past people. Oh, what does it matter? We're not really enacting this. We're not really being discriminating against women in the workforce. You know, if they were good enough, then of course they get the promotions. That's so patronizing, as many of you people know. Oh, there's no problem about not having women in the Sangha. You know, it's just, you know, if they do enough good karma, they can become men in their next life. And that's what some people say. And how gross that is. Or they can just, you know, be half nuns, not the full deal. That is really so gross. And somebody once pointed out, that's just like saying, okay, no African people, no black Africans can be monks. That's really disgusting that even people can think like that. The Buddha never had any such discrimination, even caste. You know, in Sri Lanka there are some Nikayas, some sects of Buddhism, they won't allow low caste people to be ordained as monks. That's disgusting. That's terrible. That's nothing to do with Buddhism. I know that some monks have come across. This is Thai monks. Because I always have to be fair. Because sometimes people say, I'm bagging Sri Lanka. I'm not bagging Sri Lanka. I'm bagging Thailand. I'm bagging Burma. I'm bagging everybody. Whenever they don't do good things. And they were saying, oh, this is Buddhism. It's tradition. This human rights business is coming from the West, trying to impose Western values on traditional Buddhism. Human rights, it comes from truth, from knowing what's right, from compassion. You know, it is essential to the Dhamma. Human rights comes from seeing things clearly, from fairness, justice, compassion, love to all beings. It doesn't sort of object to that, it just reaffirms what people like the Buddha saw a long time ago. Human rights is not primary, it's secondary to the truth, seeing things as they truly are. So when people come across and saying, oh, Buddhism doesn't have to have human rights, that is what I call go-mayang. Over in the United States, they knew what I meant by go-mayang. People who come on my retreats know that word. Go is the Pali Sanskrit word for bull. Mayang is for that stuff which comes out of the back end of a bull. And there are kids here, and I get complaints when I sort of say these naughty words, which the kids use at school, but I'm not supposed to say it because I'm supposed to be a religious leader. So you know what go-mayang means. So that's a lot of go-mayang. So here, if I mention the word go-mayang, you know it means, you know, BS. So there's a lot of go-mayang which comes around. Traditional early Buddhism was as equitable as you could possibly get. And why? Because you know discrimination goes against those three conceits. You're judging a person. But the Buddha actually did say, okay, you can judge a person. But on their character, on their deeds, not on their sort of fact they may have a limb which is deformed, or they may not have the same qualities as you have. Somebody asked me over there in San Francisco, I'm just going back because I'm a bit tired, so this is just some of the ideas which I was talking about. Somebody asked me, they said, you know, you are just so, this is what they said, it was a nice compliment, these are the women in Buddhism over there. They said, you know, you're so sensitive, you know, to women. We can talk with you. They said it was quite rare they could talk to a man, let alone a monk, about all their issues. And they said, tell me about your upbringing. You must have had a whole family of sisters. That's what they said. And you know what they said? And I said, no, I only had one brother, a father. My mother, she was totally dominated by us. And they say, she had to go to the football. Otherwise, she was left out. So whenever there was, we only had the two TV channels in those days, and whenever there was a football match on or a movie, football always won. My poor mother, what we did to her. But you know, this is just male. I was male dominated. So they asked me, where did you learn that sensitivity? Okay, they have to wait. This is the lines. Where did they learn that sensitivity? And the way they learned that sensitivity, when I look back on my life, was from those times when I volunteered, I said it before, when I volunteered to work with Down syndrome people. And then in Forborne Hospital, just outside of Cambridge, it was just out of ego, first of all, because one of my friends who was a Christian was volunteering to do this social work, so I decided to do some as well, to keep up the Buddhist name. That's all it was. keeping up with the Joneses. But for me, the Joneses were the Christians. So I'm a Buddhist. I can't let them outdo me anyway. So I volunteered. They only lasted 2 weeks. I lasted 2 years in this place. And I looked to those people for teaching me emotional intelligence, sensitivity. Because these were people who were disabled in one area and they compensated in other areas like people do. You don't discriminate against a person. Yeah, they, you know, you won't give them a job in a sort of a nuclear power plant. They may press the wrong button, that'll be the end of us all. But they were not very good in that area, but in the other area, in the emotions, they were geniuses. And I say that because I learned so much from them. You know, one of the first things I learned, I know I was heterosexual, I wasn't gay at all, I was afraid of anything homosexual. And they taught me how to be hugged in public as a male. And that maybe this is now, I'm 63 now. In those days, you know, if you were hugged by a male, that was just really not on in public. That means you were gay. Even gays wouldn't hug in public. And these people just run up to you and they just give this big hug. And it's nice. There's nothing wrong with that. And especially, they knew when I really needed one. Broken up with a girlfriend, bad test result, or just drunk the night before, whatever it was, because I wasn't born as a monk. Whatever it was, and I was really in a bad mood or not that good, they would come up and they would see it straight away. And I realized that, yes, they were deficient in some areas, other areas had compensated. So that's why I can't discriminate. You can't discriminate and think people with mental illness are secondary citizens. If someone has a mental illness, please do not discriminate. They are welcome. They're good in other areas. If people haven't had a great education, don't discriminate just because they haven't gone to university. Steve Jobs never finished university, neither did Einstein or Michael Dell. Don't discriminate. A person may be a bit physically deformed. They may have beautiful minds like Stephen Hawking. So why is it we look at a person and we judge them and discriminate? Most importantly, why do we look at ourselves and discriminate? I'm not good enough. You can do anything. And that's one of the reasons why, as a monk, a senior monk, at our monastery, we've got some really interesting people. I won't tell you who they are. One is a clinical schizophrenic. Incredible monk. You know, I thought that's one person could never be a monk. This person, mindfulness, wisdom, so good and really kind. I won't tell you who it is. You wouldn't know anyway. Still has to have his medication. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant monk. He's going to be one of the stars in the future, sitting up here giving great talks. There's another one, I think you probably know, he's just come out of jail into the monastery. Why not? Do you discriminate a person just because they've done a crime? They're not a criminal, they're a person who's done a crime. They're not a criminal. Give them a chance, for goodness sake. How many people have come out of jail are discriminated against when they apply for work? They just can't get a job. So what do? Stealing, back on, selling drugs, anything they can do to make ends meet, because they're discriminated against when they leave. So if you are in that area where you can employ someone, just don't just discriminate them because they've got a criminal record. Give them a chance. We all need a chance, a second chance. In Buddhism, there was this serial killer. The Buddha ordained him as a monk, became an inspiration, Angulimala. There was a person who was a prostitute, became Ambapali, became one of the famous bhikkhuni teachers. And these are inspiring for me to see. You don't discriminate at all against anybody. Give them a chance. If their character is good, if they can do it, then they should do it. That's the only thing we discriminate against. Put people in the right abilities in the right place. So please be careful. I'm run over time now, so I'm going to stop soon. Please be careful. Just don't discriminate against anybody. Don't discriminate against yourself. Because Buddhism has this beautiful loving kindness. May all beings be happy and well. Don't care who you are. Just like the sun shines on everybody.
North Koreans, whoever your enemies are, you know, they're not really enemies. So don't discriminate against anybody. Thank you very much.
Sadhu. Okay, is there any quick questions?
No. No questions from overseas.
No question. Can we have one? Or is we got the lines as well? Because, I mean, this is more important than the lines. Is there any questions? No? Going? Okay, so we've got a question now from China, which is now going to come in, namely the New Year's Eve lines. Because a lot of kids here, I'm sure they come to see the monsters. So can we have a space in the center, please? Those people who can stay, they're here, are they? Eddie? Are they here? Okay, a space in the center. Please come on the edges. If you've got kids here, please keep the kids here because kids love to see the monsters. So once you're on the side, the monsters are coming. The lions have escaped from the zoo and they're about to enter the Buddhist temple. The monsters can be very scary, but the monks and the nuns are the greatest of lion tamers. So it's going to be a bit noisy soon, the bang, bang, bangs. Those who want to go to the toilet, please go to the toilet. Please come back for the bang, bang, bang soon. And we've got firecrackers outside as well. My goodness, there's going to be a lot of noise. So please bring in the lions. Where are they? Lions. Has anyone seen a lion outside? Supposed to be out there somewhere. Here they come, here come the drums, bang, 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 here they come.